All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and our show today is, damn, it's a serious show. It's a show that you got to do. It's a show that you always want to do. It's a show that you got to do. You feel driven to do. And the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Alex Liris, who's currently, he's an actor, writer, and his current project is The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. That's right, you heard me right. We're going to be talking with Alex about this new show that he's performing. And it's a fairly notorious show, and it's also a fairly important show. So stay tuned for that. In the middle segment of the show, we're going to be talking with Dana Douglas, attorney for the family of Manuel Diaz. The other day, the Orange County District Attorney issued a report justifying the police murder of Manuel Diaz in July 2012. We are also going to be joined for a part of that segment of the show by Genevieve Huizar, who is Manuel's mom, and we're going to be hearing her reaction to the DA's decision, okay? And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome Carl Dix. Carl is a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're going to be talking with Carl about something terrible that happened in Brooklyn on March 9th, okay? And it's a very heavy scene. On March 9th, in the East Flatbush section of Brooklyn, two undercover cops ran up on and killed, outright cold-bloodedly murdered, a 16-year-old youth, Kimani Gray. They pumped 7 bullets into him, 3 into the back of his body, and then they quickly turned around and said that it was justified because this 16-year-old black youth supposedly had a gun. Okay? People responded to that in a justifiable manner that needs to be upheld. And Carl's here to talk to us about the whole thing. Carl, how you doing, man? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing good, Michael, and thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this right away. Give people a little bit more of a sense of what's happened in Brooklyn over the last 2 weeks, beginning with the incident itself and then the response to it.
Yeah, it's been a situation of outrage being piled on top of outrage. First, there's the outright murder of Kimani Gray, you know, which they followed quickly with spreading the police story that he had a gun, but eyewitnesses say there was no gun and that what happened was the NYPD had killed another black youth. Then in the days that followed, when people would gather in the neighborhood for vigils to remember Kimani or to have protest marches on the sidewalk over his murder, they would be harassed, they would be disrespected, brutalized, and dozens of people even got arrested for having protest marches in the sidewalk, for gathering at vigils on the sidewalk. This is what was going down. Then Kimani's family applied for a permit to have a legal protest march, and the NYPD denied their application for a permit. In other words, what they're saying is, we can murder your kid, but you do not have the right to protest what we do to you. That's what they're saying, and that's what this situation is and how intense it is. It's still a situation where there are cops on every street corner for a several block radius, like about 8 to 10 block radius. There are cops on every street corner. You can't move without running into them, and often you can't move because they're stopping you, asking you what you're doing in the neighborhood. If you're young and black or Latino, you get jacked up and thrown up against the wall. All of this is going down, and it's unacceptable, and people really are acting against it in a righteous way, and they need much more support.
Well, you know, Carl, I want to go back to one thing that you said as you were speaking. You talked about the cops said that he had a gun, and actually there was, and even though eyewitnesses said that he didn't have one, and this is a very heavy situation because there's a woman who is the only non-cop witness to the thing who has said, I am absolutely certain, I've seen it, he did not have a gun. The only ones that had a gun were these two guys who got out of a car, didn't even identify themselves as cops, got out of the car, started jacking the kids up, and went after him and shot him. And, you know, here's the thing is that she says this. She says that she's certain that he didn't have a gun. Yet at the same time, the cops have done everything they can to try and twist things and put out little stories about the cast uncertainty on her testimony. And, you know, even one thing I saw is they suddenly have this new character. At least I've never seen it before. You know, we know about eyewitnesses to crimes. But when the eyewitness actually contradicts what the cops said, suddenly they produced ear witnesses, you know, who claim that they heard the cops say something, you know, and they were too far away to see anything, but they had their ear witnesses, you know. And this is something that they really seem to be, you know, there's a when you talk about blatant murder, and what everybody who's described Kamani, everybody who's described, you know, and again, this one person who was the eyewitness, but other people who described the scene in the neighborhood, because this was very much related to the way I read story after story and quote after quote of people who were saying, look, this is the logical outcome of the way they treat us in the neighborhood. Can you talk about that a little, that whole scene there?
Yeah, this is a very heavily policed area before this murder, and cops undercover jumping out of a car on youth is not an unusual occurrence there. The black and Latino youth in that area are up against this all the time. And there is also a lot of talk about Kimani in that neighborhood. People knew him, and they talk about him as this was a nice kid. His middle school principal, upon hearing this, wrote a full-page letter to the newspaper about what a good student he was and what a blow this was to the school. Or this was a high school principal. They held an assembly at the middle school that he had attended a couple years ago because it was that shocking to the staff, to the teachers and the administrators that this had happened. This is the kind of kid that we're talking about who was murdered by the NYPD. And also the eyewitness, this is a woman who lived right over the scene where it happened, you know, and the TV camera went up to her window and looked out from her window right down to the scene where the killing went down. So she clearly was in position to have a good view of it. And then the cops did begin to attack her credibility, and she had talked with them, and then they started picking for, well, she did not say this to the cops. She didn't say that to the cops. And she said, well, they didn't ask me that. That's why I didn't tell them that. They weren't asking me that. They were trying to get me to corroborate what they were saying. And then when I didn't do it, the interview stopped. You know, so that's what that came down to. It is really and see, the other thing is there are hundreds of people in the neighborhood who, when they heard this story, refused to believe it. And there are other eyewitnesses who have not at this point come forward to be interviewed, because that would be being interviewed by the cops who are sweating them 24/7, day in and day out anyway. So that's why I call this a murder, you know, because the one person who has no axe to grind and has come forward is very clear that there was no gun. And is something that many, many people are refusing to accept as the truth.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we're talking about the police murder of Kimani Gray in the East Flatbush section of Brooklyn, and the rebellions that have rocked that neighborhood for quite a while, rocked the city, actually, in terms of having a tremendous impact on the entire, you know, atmosphere in the city. You know, Carl, one thing I wanted to point out, too, is that, you know, these cops that actually that carried out the murder, while they're talking about, you know, let me put it this way. There's been this sort of murdering twice phenomenon that goes on. And, you know, the fact that, you know, there's this whole people in the neighborhood and the principal and all this stuff telling what a sweet guy, a nice guy that Kamani was. And they're saying, look, even, you know, he wasn't an angel, but, you know, he was a kid. He was just a kid, you know, and he did things that kids did. And then, but the police had this whole thing about how he was a ruthless gang member. He was this, he was that, you know, all the stuff that's built up to demonize him. And at the same time, they have sort of quietly buried or overlooked the fact that these two cops who were involved in killing him, actually both of them have a history of violation of rights and doctoring evidence in order to back up what they do to people, back up their story about what they do to people. This is kind of the murdering twice and then taken to another level with this whole, we're not going to tell you what the cops actually did.
Yeah. I mean, they first laid out that these two, they wouldn't name them, and they talked about how they were decorated officers. That was all they would say about them. Then someone was able to dig into their background and found out, well, yeah, they were decorated, but they also had numerous complaints against them of violence against people, violating people's rights, planting evidence, all of this kind of stuff. And it was a thing of murdering Kimani twice by killing him and then trying to kill his reputation in order to justify having killing him, but then also covering up who exactly it was that did this killing. And see, all of this fit into the response of the people in the neighborhood, because one, they refused to believe the police story around Kimani. Two, when they were attacked for remembering their friend, they refused to back down. Because and there's a lot of talk about the masses having risen up in the neighborhood, rebelling, and they're being castigated for that, as well as there's talk about, well, the outsiders riled them up. See, and this is BS on a number of counts. First off, what people did was righteous. If they had not done that, this would have been another killing of a black youth by the police that got swept under the rug. The only reason they haven't been able to do that is because people stood up and resisted around it. And then the other thing is to talk about outsiders riling people up. If there are some outsiders whose actions are riling people up, it is the NYPD. First by murdering this young man, then by telling people they have no right to express their outrage and their grief around this murder, going on attacking people at vigils, people just marching along the sidewalk, which there is no law against. The police will try to run over them with their scooters, try to block their forward progress, different things like that, telling people you ain't got no rights anymore in this area. They deny that it's an official frozen zone, but they will bring out riot police, block the streets, try to entrap people and sweep them up. They arrested 45 people during one of the many mass protest marches that have happened. And the only reason they didn't arrest more is that a lot of the youth were just too quick for them and jumped over the scooters and proceeded on to the aim of their protest, which was to get to the police precinct to demonstrate their outrage at this foul murder. That's what's going down. And see, this talk about outsiders is basically coming down to saying to people who hear about this that they should stand by and do nothing in the face of this injustice. And it also comes down to leaving the people who've been bearing the brunt of this intense repression and suppression by the police, leaving them on their own and alone to face it. And to the credit of a lot of people, they have refused to do that and said, no, there are no outsiders in the fight against injustice. I mean, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network has been in the neighborhood and, in fact, is calling a protest for this Sunday and fighting to get a permit for it. People from Occupy Wall Street have come. Other forces have felt like they had to be there with people. And just people, you know, people from Harlem have come down to stand with the people in Brooklyn. People from all over the city are responding to it.
You know, I noticed one very powerful addition there is that a number of parents of people who've been killed by the police over the last decades were also at some of the protests during this. Whether it was Nicholas Hayward, Juanita Young, Margarito Rosario, you know, very powerful stand when they came down with a banner around stolen lives and stood with the family and the people in East Flatbush.
Yeah, the Stolen Lives banner that you're talking about is very important because it lists hundreds of people who have been killed by the NYPD. You know, and when the cops want to talk about how rare it is that they kill anybody, this banner points out that they are lying, and it shows that these are not isolated incidents, but a concentration of the oppression that comes down, particularly on black and Latino people. And see, the other thing about this is it points to what's needed to deal with it. Because this is not an isolated incident. It happens all the damn time. And I'll tell you, and I say this in a statement that I just issued on this, it'll take revolution, nothing less, to end the horror of police murders, police brutality, as well as all of the other horrors that people face around the world, whether that's wars for empire, like the war in Iraq that 10 years, you know, started 10 years ago, like the plunder of the environment, the violence and degradation against women. That's what it'll take, that and nothing less, to bring all this to a close, you know, to end it once and for all, and bring into being the kind of world people should live in, because we should live in a world where those entrusted with public safety would sooner risk their own lives than injure or kill an innocent person. And it'll definitely take a revolution to bring that kind of world into being, because the way this society works, the cops have a license to kill, and they get backed up when they kill people. And then people are told that they should give the cop the benefit of the doubt. Here you have a 16-year-old kid and so-called trained law enforcement personnel who gunned this kid down because they say he had a gun. And then if you actually get more deeply into their story, they say at first he was adjusting his waistband, and that's what led them to him, you know. And we got to give them the benefit of the doubt, you know, like with the Romali Graham thing. They said they had saw a suspicious bulge and chased into his house, broke into his house, and killed him. We should give them the benefit of the doubt. No, we should not give them the benefit of the doubt. We should call them out for their crimes, but call out the system, the criminal system that they are enforcing and keeping in effect.
All right, Carl, with that, we're gonna have to move on, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Let me give the website that
yes.
people can find my latest statement on. It's www.revcom.us, and we're going to have continuing coverage on that site. People can also go to the site of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network to watch its activities. That's stopmassincarceration.org.
All right, and we will be following that, and as things develop, we'll probably have you back on to tell us about it, all right?
Okay, I'm available.
All right, thanks a lot, Carl. All right, talk to you again soon. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix, founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about the brutal police murder of Kimani Gray in the East Flatbush section of Brooklyn and the rebellion that's followed in its aftermath, the cause and the solution. And coming up next, we'll be talking with Dana Douglas, the attorney for the family of Manuel Diaz, a young Latino man who was murdered by the Anaheim police in Orange County, California, last July of 2012. And just recently, the Orange County, California's DA announced that the cop who murdered Manuel Diaz cannot be held responsible for it. According to the DA, there's no basis for bringing charges against this cop for the wanton murder of this young, unarmed Latino man. Yet another outrage heaped upon the people, and we'll be talking with Dana Douglas, the attorney for the family, as well as Genevieve Huizar, the mother of Manuel Diaz. So stay tuned for that. But before we get there, I want people to listen to this song, to this musical break. We're going to take a quick musical break. Well, maybe not so quick. I want people to hear a couple minutes of this song. Really let it sink in. Think about it. And it'll set the stage for our next conversation. So stay tuned.
Oh, boy, I am so tired. I'll be glad when I get inside the house. Oh, I dropped my keys. Oh, what's this bright light? My God, they must gonna rob me. With these people, with the money, they're gonna rob me. I'm gonna take out my wallet to make sure they just get the money and nothing else. Oh, wait. That's the police. Oh, I feel so much better. I will show them I have my ID so they know I am good people.
Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod with me. Ja! Rastafari, I can't forget you, Naughty Dreads, you're up in here. I gotta respect that, you know what I'm saying? Light is in the air. Enemy on the borderline, who'll be the next to fire? 41 shots by Diallo side. You said he reached, sir, but he didn't have no peace, sir. But now he rests in peace, sir, in the belly of the beast, sir.
All right, welcome back. That is Diallo from Wycliffe Jean talking about Amadou Diallo and how he was murdered by the police for the crime of being a black man late at night trying to unlock the front door of his apartment building. All right, and I couldn't think of a better song to fit the whole first half of today's show. This kind of wanton police murder is something that we've all got to stand up against and stand with the people who are standing up and saying, we're not going to live like this anymore. We're not going to take it. We're going to stand up against this and against the system that actually carries it out, the system that the police serve. Now, last summer, in July of 2012, the police in Anaheim, California, carried out a brutal murder of a young Latino man named Manuel Diaz. Now, Manuel was a young man in the Anna Drive neighborhood of Anaheim, California. And when the police apparently approached him and a group of his friends, for whatever reason, Manuel decided he was going to take off. He didn't want to be hassled that day. Whatever. He took off. The police chased him. And while he had his back turned to them, they shot him. They shot him once in the butt and once in the back of the head, killing him. Again, wanton murder. Immediately after that murder became known throughout the neighborhood, all kinds of people rose up in rebellion. There were days, almost a week of rebellion. The neighborhood seethed. There was massive repression and oppression unleashed by the Anaheim police, joined with federal agents and the rest of them pulling all kinds of raids. But still, the people have stood up and refused to accept the murder of Manuel Diaz and another young man who was killed by the Anaheim police just a day or so later. Now, 6 or 7 months later, 8 months later, the Orange County, California DA has issued a report that said the cop that killed Manuel Diaz was justified in doing so. Just an outrageous cover-up and an outrageous display of what really are the relationships between the police and the people and who the police serve, not the people, but the system itself that keeps people down. Joining us now to talk about all this is Dana Douglas. Dana Douglas is the attorney for Manuel Diaz's family, and she had quite a bit to say about that, and it really just knocked my head back. I really wanted to give her a chance to come on and talk about all this. And we're also going to be joined a little later by Manuel Diaz's mom, and her name is Genevieve Weavesar. And we're going to talk with her about her feelings about the about what's happened in all this and about her son's murder and the DA's ruling. So, Dana, welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks for having me on, and nice to talk to you.
Sure. Well, you were very, I mean, one of the things that grabbed me about and one of the reasons I really wanted to get you immediately on the show, your comment on this, when you looked at what the DA had said, you basically called it out as for what it was. You basically said, look, you know, this is just biased. It's just, you know, basically it's insane. And yet you also said, you weren't surprised that you could have written this report yourself a day after the incident. Let's talk about that.
Right. Well, that's true. I could have written it the day after the incident because the fact of the matter is this is the way they go 100% of the time, particularly in Orange County, California. In Orange County, the district attorney there has never, not once, ever brought charges against any police officer for shooting and killing an innocent person or a guilty person. For no shooting has the DA ever filed charges against the police officer. And part of the thing is, they're on the same team. They work together. They have the same mentality. They have the same way, the same worldview, the same view that they're the righteous truth seekers trying to get justice against in a system that's set up against them. And so there's real, while the DA is supposed to have an unbiased analytical look at this to see if there's sufficient evidence in which to prosecute the defendant, the police officer, defendant, suspect, they don't really do that. What they do instead is they circle the wagons because they're, after all, on the same team. They work together every day, day in and day out. This officer, Nick Buckshot Benelak, 5-year veteran, probably been working with the DA on 100 or more cases. They're on the same team. So what they really do, what the DA really does, rather than just giving it that neutral evaluation that they're supposed to, they take the essentially the officer's side and see if there's any way they can avoid filing charges. This is just the fact of life. District attorneys and police officers, they believe in what they're doing, and frankly, most of them do a fantastic job. Police officers, prosecutors do wonderful things. They take horrible, evil people off the street and put them away. But they are a little over-enthusiastic, particularly when it comes to defending a police officer in something like this. And in this particular report, they didn't stick to the facts and provide a neutral view and decide whether or not there was enough evidence to prosecute Benelak. And I guarantee you that under the same facts, if somebody in the neighborhood had shot someone under the same circumstances, they'd be in jail waiting trial. Instead, this report went farther than any report I've ever seen, and I've seen them for over 20 years, any report I've ever seen in justifying and going out of their way to try to justify the shooting, even going so far as to to release salacious photos of the decedent, of Mr. Diaz, and to dredge up false and defamatory things against him, and put those in the report, which had nothing at all to do with the shooting and the facts of the shooting, which is what they should have been focusing on. This report was 20-some-odd pages long, substantially longer than they usually do, and they spent a great deal of time in it trying to justify witnesses that the police had found not believable in order to justify the shooting. It was the, you know, they usually sound pretty neutral, but this one didn't even sound neutral.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Dana Douglas, the attorney for the family of Manuel Diaz, a young Latino man in Anaheim, California, who was wantonly murdered by the Anaheim, California police in July of 2012. And just recently, the district attorney in Orange County, California, decided that there was not enough evidence to charge the cop that killed Manuel Diaz with murder.
I also want to make a point to people that actually some of this thing, while the cops say that there was no evidence to support a finding of criminal culpability, that it kind of begs the question of the evidence that was there. And what and actually even the point of here's a young man who was shot in the back of the head. You know, turned away from them, even then they'd go to this thing of, well, he was turning his head to look and see. But it was like he was facing, you know, his body was in the other direction. He was shot in the back of the head and then in the butt. And you know, that's just dismissed. To me, it was like it's really incredible what, you know, and I think what you're saying is an extremely important point, because here's the point. One of the things that jumped out at me about this report was the DA said that there were three factors that led to the decision that this cop was justified. And this is classic, okay? And it's the point they say the three facts are provided to support this, that Diaz had a prior felony conviction for possessing a gun for the benefit of a gang, a cell phone found nearby, including photos of Diaz posing with a gun days before, and a raid weeks later on gang members that found 40 guns, none of which has anything to do with the fact that, hello, you killed this man. Here, this is the particular thing we're talking about. I don't care what those three key factors. It means nothing. You killed this man, and it's completely just whitewashed and thrown away.
Well, let's look at the facts of what occurred at the time, and not what's in the report. But the facts that they state, and I'll restrict myself to the facts that they put in the report. When Benelec rolled up on these men who were standing around having a conversation. And by the way, let me give you a little aside. There is a social component to these shootings. It's both racial and economic. Anaheim is really two different cities. There's the Anaheim Hills, rich white area, and then the flatlands where this shooting occurred, which is mostly Hispanic and mostly impoverished. These are the people who work for Disneyland, work for the hotels, support the tourist business, and these are poor areas. So there's really two Anaheims here. In Anaheim Hills, in the white area, affluent area, three young white men standing around have nothing to fear from the police. The police don't roll up and rouse them, and even if they did, those young men would have nothing to fear from those police. Not so in these poor areas where people have brown skin. Instead, in those areas, police target young men like this, and these young men never, ever have a positive interaction with police. It's always negative. So when Benelec and his partner rolled up on these guys who were standing around talking, everybody knew what was going to happen at that point. Benelec and his partner Heitman knew they were going to roust these kids, and these kids knew they were going to be rousted. And so Manuel Diaz took off. I don't need this grief, and so he says, I'm out of here. So he takes off, and Benelec starts running after him. They round a corner together, and Manuel Diaz runs into an area that he can't get out of. There's a fence in there. So he's running toward this fence as if he's about to climb over it. Now, according to the report, he's looking back over his shoulder, Benelec says, to be targeted, but he's looking over his shoulder to see who's chasing him and how far they are away. When he gets to the fence, Benelec shoots him, first in the buttocks, driving him to his knees, and then in the back of the head, two shots. Here are some facts.
Boy.
Diaz had no gun. He didn't point anything at Benelec. He didn't threaten Benelak in any way. He wasn't making any menacing gestures. Over 50 witnesses interviewed, not a single one said that he pointed anything at Benelak or made any gestures toward Benelak whatsoever. Benelak is trigger happy. He shot another man just a few months earlier who was doing nothing wrong and killed him, and the Anaheim police put him right back out on the street. Frankly, the guy doesn't have the temperament to be a police officer. In both of those killings that Benelak did, there were other officers present, and in neither of those situations did any other officer fire, only Benelak. And then they put him right back out on the street without any training, without any supervision, and he's back out there again today. It's just a matter of time before he gets somebody else.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Dana Douglas, the attorney for the family of Manuel Diaz, a young Latino man in Anaheim, California, who was wantonly murdered by the Anaheim, California police in July of 2012. And just recently, the district attorney in Orange County, California, decided that there was not enough evidence to charge the cop that killed Manuel Diaz with murder. Let me ask you this, Dana, and then I'm going to bring on Genevieve. You likened this whole situation, this DA's report, to a rape case, and you said blame the victim. Let's talk about that.
Sure, happy to. This is what happens in police shooting cases all over the country. In fact, what you were talking about with Kamani Gray before in the last segment, same thing. I was sitting there listening to it thinking this is exactly what happened with Manuel Diaz. What happens in all police shooting cases, especially the bad ones, but in all of them, the police and prosecutors, they circle the wagons and they tarnish the victim. Just like in rape cases, whoever commits the rape and their people, they circle the wagons and they defend against that rape by tarnishing the rape victim. Same thing here. Their tactic, their whole thing here is to blame the victim for this murder. They talk about, oh, he's a bad guy. They tell untrue things. They say he's a gang member. He made threatening things. The police union president said that he was a violent gang member. And they released a statement saying that yesterday. You know what? Mr. Diaz never committed a violent act in his life, and I defy the police union or any police officers to identify a single violent act that Manuel Diaz ever committed, unlike the police officer who, like the rapist, is the one who committed the violence. And yet they're blaming the victim in order to deflect from their own behavior and to poison. What they want to do is poison the water so that people start in the community start thinking, well, this was a bad guy, so it was okay somehow, as if we don't have a constitution and due process that we're supposed to follow. But, you know, well, the cop shot a bad guy, so even if this wasn't really a good shoot, I guess we'll give him a little pat on the back for getting rid of a bad guy.
Okay, but Dana.
That's not how it's going to work.
Right, and before I bring Genevieve on, I wanted to actually add a little thing here, too, because there is a point, too, that, and you can see this in terms of the demonization of the individuals that are killed and all the things that happen, and including the systematic oppression that comes down on people from the police on a daily basis. One of the things I actually found very interesting was that the head of the police association down there immediately stepped out in the wake of the DA's ruling and said that, well, you know, this just goes to show you, we've been telling you this all the time, the police here, they're confronting demons, devils, and monsters, and every day they go in there, and they have to do this, and they have to do this, and people don't understand, we have to police a certain way because these people are less than human. And I think that's what you're saying is extremely important, this point about blaming the victim. I now want to bring Genevieve Huizar, who is the mom of Manuel Diaz, onto the show. Genevieve, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking our call, having us on your show. You know, everything that was just said by both you and Dana, it really hurts my heart knowing that these officers went over there purposely to kill my son. He wasn't committing a crime. He didn't have a gun. You know, this is my only son. And I was hearing your show just a little earlier about New York. I just want people to know that we don't have color lines, street lines, city lines, county lines, or state lines. We want to help people across the United States. We want to be helped by people across the United States. We want a movement so big to change these officers' Bill of Rights that they're protected under.
I'd like people to know, you know, like we were just talking about the blaming the victim, and this has been massive in relation to your son, in relation to Manuel. Can you tell us a little bit about Manuel?
Of course. He was a good son. He was just a loving son. You know, at home, he made everybody laugh. He played with all his nieces and nephews. He was a good student. He went to the Job Corps. He played basketball. He played football. You know, ever since he was just a little kid, he just, my heart. And they ripped that away from me.
Boy, it's, you know, just so outrageous. One of the things I'd ask you as well is, you know, they had a, basically, they've tried to portray Manuel as this monster, and you've done a lot to actually counter that. And, you know, you also stood up to them. You refused to disappear in the face of their efforts to sort of make their story the official story. That's it. You've actually been out there fighting. What was your reaction now to the DA's report? When you saw that report, what was your reaction?
I saw a bunch of lies. That's what I saw. You know, I see cover-up. I see manipulation. I don't believe half of what's in that report. I believe Benelec is a murderer. He executed my son. And for that, he needs to go to prison. And I will continue to fight. I continue to go. We had a candlelight vigil last night for Manuel. And there was about 30, 35 people. And it was just beautiful. The people are still coming out for him.
That's very important. And are there any other plans in the works?
Yes, we march every Sunday. There's not one Sunday that we haven't marched for another family going through this. We go to Reseda, Lakewood, Compton, Pomona, Downey. We go everywhere and we support other families in this type of situation, murder by police.
You know, and that's extremely important. I think we'll wrap up on that point. And I really want to go back to the point that you said, as when we began this, that when you were listening to the situation in New York, and that there's no state line, there's no neighborhood line, there's no color line, there's no people line, but there's a line of people who've been brutalized and terrorized by the police, and that people need to stand up against.
Yes.
Genevieve, any last final comments?
I just want to say that we are all one. We need to prove the injustices of these officers. They're covered by their Bill of Rights, and those Bill of Rights have to be changed.
Mm-hmm. Genevieve, thank you very much for joining us today.
Sure.
Thank you. Dana, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay, we'll talk to you all again soon.
Take care now.
All right, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Dana Douglas, the lawyer for the family of Manuel Diaz, and we've been talking with Genevieve Huizar, Manuel Diaz's mom. And I want to read something because I think it's extremely important, and it's because I'm so outraged by this, and I want to read something before we move on to our next segment. It is up to us to wake up, to shake off the ways they put on us, the ways they have us thinking so they can keep us down and trapped in the same old rat race, to rise up as conscious emancipators of humanity. The days when this system can just keep on doing what it does to people here and all over the world, when people are not inspired and organized to stand up against these outrages and to build up the strength to put an end to this madness, those days must be gone, and they can be. And that's from the statement, The Revolution We Need, The Leadership We Have, a message and call from the Revolutionary Communist Party. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with writer-actor Alex Liris about his staging of the play, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. So stay tuned.
Feeling like a fly stuck to flypaper, or a stressed office worker jumping off top of a skyscraper. I take it deep in the ground to where my step pop is found, in the mind digging cool all the time. Perhaps one to make it out without getting black lung. I hope from my heart, already know where the rap's from. Trapped in a modern day manslaughter, it's real. Asbestos in the lungs is what killed my grandfather. I couldn't have ran farther. Fleeing the factory, constantly looking in back of me, wondering why it had to be. Battling the power since grade school, deploring unjust authority, conformity, mama didn't raise a fool. Say what you like, call me fringe left or lazy, but if you think I'll be a slave, you must be f***ing crazy. Maybe we'll be free, or maybe I just wish this, but I'd rather fight and lose than ever settle for this. Every day I wake up on the wrong side of capitalism, poverty feeling like...
That's right, every day I wake up on the wrong side of capitalism, all right? That's Sunrise Above, and I couldn't think of a more fitting song for the entire show, but especially for this segment. All right, joining us now is Alex Liris. Alex is a writer, an actor, a producer, and actually
Renaissance man.
at Renaissance Man. There you go. He's the great and mighty Oz, okay? Look for him behind every curtain, all right? And Alex Sexy is also in. He's putting on a very powerful performance. It's an incredible, incredible performance of the play, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you this. First, you know, the play is, well, first off, tell people what the play is, because people hear that thing and it's sort of, I don't know, some people might have some sense of it, but it's actually, it's a very compelling and intriguing title. Tell people what the play's about.
The play's about where your iPhone comes from. And it sits in our pockets. We're not quite sure, but they're built in China in these factories. And, you know, Apple is over here telling people how gorgeous everything is and wonderful everything is. But it turns out there's a little bit of a pernicious side to the story. And at the same time, it praises a genius, Steve Jobs. This is a guy who literally changed the world. But he blinded himself a little bit to the reality of how that change was going to be implemented. Here they are saying think different, and they're not thinking very differently. They're exploiting workers in China.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there is a point, too, where, you know, whatever Steve Jobs' genius was, you know, there's a point, too, to the fact that, and it's very interesting because it's tied into the whole way that he was actually able to even have the time and the ability to do what he did, had a lot to do with what overall his company has relied on and propagated and furthered in terms of exploitation and oppression of people all around the world, you know, because he was sort of in a swimming pool that was filled and he was floating on top of all this free time and the ability to do what he did, including, you know, dig into the kinds of things that he did with computers. And it just sort of struck me as I was watching the play and, you know, it's like there's so much going on in here in terms of the contradictions involved in all this.
It makes it really interesting. And the play is written by Mike Daisy, and it's very well woven together. It's funny. It's engaging. It talks about the history, where these guys met. And this is the conflict. The conflict is capitalism, for all of its intense side effects, does produce creativity, and the competition is necessary to drive people. There's a small window of success like any political system, and it's gotten a little bit out of control.
Well, you know, the competition and the drive, and when the thing I would say is that the competition and drive, I mean, the drive for profit is really what ends up controlling everything. And that's one of the reasons why, in my mind, capitalism's got to go. Okay. But the whole point of, you know, even and what it does, and it's hidden from us in the world. And that's one of the things I think that you bring out in the play and that Daisy brought out. But I think that you bring a certain power to it in your performance of it. The idea that so much of this is hidden and it's not necessarily what we want to know.
Yes. That continues to be – I'm amazed. So this play was done at the Public Theater in New York and in Berkeley and at the Woolly Mammoth and here in California, where I would say we are – Mac heavy and tech heavy, and everyone knows. People still really don't know a lot of the basics. They don't know what Shenzhen is. People, they think their stuff comes from China, but really it's one small area, the Guangzhou province, that was 31 years ago made into a factory zone like we have never seen the likes of. It's like 10 airports next to each other, and that is China making 50% of the electronics in the world. And you forget that, you know, this is intentional. This was, profit was the bottom line. They wanted to come from one specific place. They made deals with everybody, all the corporations. They're like, yes, we're not going to be hard on you. So you are seeing this unfold in the play in a way that is bookended by these other stories. And it'll draw you in, that's for sure.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. And we're talking today with Alex Liris, who's an actor, writer, and he's currently performing in Mike Daisy's play, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. And actually, it's something that you have actually added to and developed in your own right, too, right?
Yes, after the whole,
Now, what we were talking about just now, you know, here's a question for you. Well, let me ask you this first, all right? Because I can't interview you without, and you know, and I know you get hit it all the time because it's a difficult play to do, one, because you know it was going to get hit because it poked them in the eye.
Yes.
Not just Apple, but the entire system. It poked them in the eye. And if you think you're going to poke somebody in the eye and get away with it, you better be prepared for the outcome there. And the thing is that, you know, there was a major controversy that most people know about, I think, that Daisy was actually accused of and admitted that he had doctored some things in the course of the play, made it seem like this was actually factual and it wasn't. What do you think about the controversy and what impact did it have on you in deciding to do this play?
I'll reduce it to, you know, as quickly as I can because there's so many other things to talk about. But, Daisy made up some facts. When you compare the two scripts, 90% of the script is still intact. It's the message that we want to tell people that these phones that we pay, how little we pay for them, they're cheap for a reason. And they're cheap for a reason because they're squeezing margins in China. If these things come back to America, they'll be a little bit more expensive. And guess what? Everyone can afford them. Every broke actor I know has an iPhone and a plan that he pays for. And if it's $100 more, he'll figure out how to do it. So nobody's broke like we're all claiming we are. And we can all pay a little more, and we should pay a little bit more. So the controversy is a shame. I wonder why it came. Yes, he poked Apple in the eye, and maybe there was some bigger story about why they took him down. But the fabrication of the facts is not that gratuitous. The main thing about the victory of this play is a theater person took on a corporation and affected change. When you see a play like that, when you see theater that you're not bored to death with or like, how did I get here, or groan, and you see a play that inspires conversation after at the bar where people are like, this is what I thought and this is what I thought, and you can sit back and listen, that is success at its best. It's theater at its best.
Let me ask you this, because it's also something that was raised to me even as that controversy broke out, and it's something you've spoken to in many places, but you know, I always thought, look, there's a difference between journalism and theater. There's a difference between, you know, theatrical art and journalism, you know. And journalism, even I engage in, you know, and have written for years in literary journalism.
Yes.
But it's still journalism, and I don't play with the facts.
Yes,
you know?
Right.
But I do, you know, build atmosphere around it. But still, there's a core there. But there's a difference between theater and journalism. And theater has a whole different role to play and a whole different way of being built. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, the first thing about journalism, you know, I was a language of philosophy. I was a philosophy major, and philosophy of language was a big part of it. The second you open your mouth and you put a thought into language, there's going to be a discrepancy. There is your interpretation no matter what. So journalism, pure journalism, is always an uphill battle because you're a subject reporting on something. But the first caveman that came back and tried to explain in the few words that he had about the fight he had with the saber-toothed tiger was adding interpretation and emotion to it. So I don't want strict journalism in the theater. I mean, I'm at the point where even reading the New York Times, I'm getting more out of the op-eds than the article. I can read the first paragraph and know, now I want to hear some opinions. Let me read both opinions, the left and the right, and let me see the spin, and let me create my own desire. So, yes, the theater is a place for engaging people emotionally, and that's what's missing from the newspaper. That's why the newspaper is step one, and then you want to get emotionally involved. So that's what Mike Daisy was doing. And he was reporting in the first person, but he made the fatal error of embellishing on some facts that people found, and that was the whole core.
Well, I will just end that kind of discussion. I was actually didn't want to go back to Daisy, but the point that you made with him is that actually if he had just used the word based on, you know, and that's fine. And I think that's really the case here. And you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Alex Liris, writer, director, producer, and we're talking with Alex about his staging of Mike Daisy's very controversial play, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. Well, let me put it this way. This is very different for you.
Yeah.
Because you do solo work that you write.
Yeah.
And you not only stepped into a play that was full of controversy from the very beginning, but you were stepping into a play that where you were putting yourself. And it's because it's done in a sort of an autobiographical format.
Yeah.
You're doing somebody else.
It's you know, the wisest of my friends who are experienced actors and writers are curious about it, and it's better if you don't know me because then you can take the ride of this beautiful piece of work. But yes, there are some point of view things. I'm saying I, and. But it still works. It still holds up. I like to do a much more. I don't want to say creative because I think this is creative, but a much more immersed thing. Even if it's a solo show, I never talk about my own life and my own work, really. I like to interpret events and create metaphors. and weaves stories together in a much more literary way, then this is more like a documentary.
What made you want to do this then?
Well, I did it at my college at Bucknell. They were doing a tech conference. And the tech conference, they had Wilkinson, who had written the biography, and Rebecca Skloot had been on, and she was talking about biotechnology and everything. So they had some heavy hitters, and they asked Mike Daisy to do it, and he was not able to because this controversy had just broken. So I did it, and I had memorized this play, and it was awesome because they interrupted the show, and students were doing contributing to the piece in a very academic way. So a professor from the Guangzhou Province, who was a Chinese professor, was like, ah, let me tell you why I can't. Why this is, doesn't work. And so the play unfolded. I'd memorized it for Bucknell. That was in the fall. And just one thing leading into this whole thing, this professor told me that the reason that Apple can't just compensate workers at this factory, the Shenzhen factory, is because it will raise them to a higher class level. Now, we are forgetting something in this country, although we hear it every day, China. China's a communist country. These are communists over there. You are shaking your head no, but it's a lot different than what we have. Yes, it's an oligarchy, but at the same time, we are forgetting this is they are trying to keep people at one class. So Apple can't just reward their workers and pay them a little more because that elevates those workers.
Yeah, although now I feel obliged because I want to, you know, I'll put out, you want to hear the other opinion, which is, and I'll be brief, but you know, it's also a question. Look, here's the point. China became a capitalist country about 35 years ago. It had a coup there. And the problem now, the reason they're not going to pay workers the right amount of money or whatever that right amount of money is, that's not even really the question. The question is the Chinese, like Apple, like everything else, are solely driven for profit. They want to maximize profit. This is why you see all the terrible things that are going on, including the mass loss of land in the countryside, people flooding to the cities, not being able to find work, not being able to find a living wage. So I think it's really something to think about in terms of that. Now, let me ask you another question here. Let me ask you this. I don't know if you're prepared to do this, but could you give people a little taste of the play?
Yeah, this is a section that I love. It starts off 30,000 workers in a single enormous space. It can exert a type of nefarious mentality on you to see human industrialization on this scale. And there are people behind you when you're touring the factories, whispering statistics in your ear. It's not that difficult to fall into a kind of Stalinist wet dream. Now, do you really think Apple doesn't know? In a company that mills the aluminum just so on each device, the fact that you can't see a single screw in one of their phones, do you really think it's credible that they didn't know? Of course they knew. They've always known.
All right. There you go. Exactly the point. Which brings me to this question. There's a line in the play that you've actually pointed to as something that you really grabbed onto, and it's Steve Jobs, this genius of design and form, forgot the most essential rule of design there is. The way the thing is made is part of the design itself. Let's talk about that.
It's about integrity. That's about integrity. And everyone is so hyperventilating to have success in whatever it is, whether you're designing a new coffee maker or you're trying to sell your screenplay. So then you're talking to your agent. And he's like, is this based on a true story? And you're like, yeah. Will that sell it? Yeah, it's based, you know. Hey, guess what? Everything's based on a true story. Life happens and we base our work on it. So yeah, that line is big. It applies to all of us. You know, we're in such a rush to get ahead that we will do whatever we have to do, which is either fudging the facts or making something up to make it look sexier, to sell it quicker. And it's unfortunate because with a little bit more patience and a little bit more respect for something like integrity, which you'll find goes a long way, you don't need to do these little shortcuts that people are doing every day. And this brings me back to the side effects of capitalism, which I know you know well. Does Apple need to be number one? Do they need to be the richest? Do they need a $100 billion surplus? Do they need $100 billion? What if they had 50? What if they had 50 and were treating workers a little better? Wouldn't that be cool? Would we be sitting here talking about them like we're talking about them? The word is out. Michael says yes, we would. We'd go for them anyway.
Yeah, you're right.
So, you know, that line is a big line, and it applies to you raising your kids or you writing a screenplay. Like, how you're designing them It's part of it.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Alex Liris, actor, producer, writer. And we're talking about Alex's staging of Mike Daisy's play, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. Now, let's talk about this. When you talk about this play, you talk about it in terms of social activist theater. And is this a new thing for you, or is this something you've often delved into? And how do you look at that in terms of its importance in the theater world?
It's got to be about something. It's got to be about something important. So my last play, The Common Air, was about, the spin after 9/11, and I had been in New York for that. And, you know, we got Iraqi cab drivers in New York City, and they are American. You know, they're speaking with an accent. But to me, it was just understanding that we all create our own reality every day, whether you're a cab driver or a soldier, or you've got to rationalize your existence on this planet. So as a philosophy major, I love to include ideas in my work, and it's always about something. The first play I did was about kids getting out of college and, you know, missing the point, trying to be something. Hey, I'm a lawyer. Hey, I'm this. I'm like, what about, you know, is anyone doing anything for society at large, or is anybody working for a charity, or is anybody doing anything? So that was the first question. So yes, and this play drew me to it for that reason. It will affect me in the future where I find a subject matter and can do a simple performance, because the other ones were months of study on accents and interweaving these stories and props and sets. It would be good to do something about theater and ancient Greece and how we've gotten to Hollywood from ancient Greece and where theater began and where our voices started coming from, with a laptop and myself, and make it simple. So this play influenced me. It's socially oriented.
And you also have to deal with all of your friends and all the people you don't know except through being in the audience and the thing, who are now the kids that got out of college and will stand all night in line waiting for the latest Apple thing to come out. And you have to deal with the thing of them saying, yo, man, you just bummed the hell out of me.
Yeah, that was rough. After my other shows that were, you know, people are inspired, and this is the experience that you sometimes get. People are like, oh, my God, I'm awake.
They're awake, and they better stay awake and stand up. Alex, we got to run, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
A pleasure.
Sure. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. But before we go, I have a couple of announcements I want to make. Some of you have written into me over the last couple of weeks and asked me about the premiere, the premiere of the film B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. Well, that premiere happened, and it was a great success in four cities across the country. And I'm really pleased to be able to tell you now that a DVD of that film is available, and you can find out all the details about getting one, about how you can pick it up, how you can get it, and getting in touch with people about it at revcom.us. That's R-E-V, V as in victory, C-O-M, M as in Michael, .us. All right, so go there and you can find out all you need to know about the DVD of the film B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party. And I want to thank Dana Douglas and Genevieve Huizar. And I also want to thank Alex Liris. And last but certainly not least, I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. And each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We'll talk to you again next week, and we're going out with Revolutionary Dream from Pablo Moses.
A revolutionary dream, people listen keen. Freedom fight, I was in my dream. I was on this mountain with other soldiers awaiting others for attack the oppressors. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, whoa, whoa.